Galaxy 13, Channel 16, Audio 7.70, and worldwide on the internet at FirstAmendmentRadio.com.
Roll away the dawn, roll away the dawn, and let me see the land of the free. Has anything changed at home? Sweet liberty, sweet liberty. Plan, or is it a state of mind? Never forget.
You're listening to Jackie Patru and Sweet Liberty. And now here's your host, Jackie Patru.
Good evening, ladies and gentlemen. Thank you for joining us tonight on Sweet Liberty. Of course, it is Monday. It is actually the 4th. Of course, the 4th of July and all of the holidays, so that the government workers can get an extra day of pay without work. Turns a holiday into a Monday, yes. So I hope you've had a lovely weekend thus far. I've been out in the garden, and we've had a couple of nice days. It was up to 92 again today. Makes it a little tough, but you got to make hay while the sun shines, yes. What I'm going to do tonight, folks, I've read Alan Watts' book, the third one, called Cutting Through, and the end of the book was not really a wrap-up, but kind of. And I want to share some of this. I didn't ask Alan's permission to do this, and I hope he doesn't mind, but I just wanted to share this with you because I think it is also relevant. The entire book is. It's a book that I'm going to have to read more than once in order to feel that I've got the most out of it. Let me share our spiritual message with you this evening. This is from the cards I pulled, the Course in Miracles. This is from the text, page 287 of the Course in Miracles. My kingdom is not of this world, because it is in you, and you are of your Father. And to be in the kingdom is merely to focus your full attention on it. Well, they make that tough, don't they? I'm going to start after his chapter on Revelations. Not going to try to read that to you. It is something you have to read yourself. I think it would be difficult to follow the writing if I were trying to read it. And this last part of it is a lot of it is mostly Alan's comments and commentary. And so we're going to start on page 66. He was explaining here the symbology behind all of the religions, and it all has to do with the astrological movements. But anyway, he says there is behind all this symbology a very well-concealed plan. It does predate Judaism for at least 3,500 years, although it can be said the Torah and Talmud have a part to play with their depiction of the new perfect male to come in the new age. The age of Aquarius, with its peace and understanding, has a different view of how this is to be achieved. Ganymede, the most, quote, beautiful boy of Greece, was swimming in the water when Zeus, who was bisexual, went mad with lust for the boy. Zeus turned into an eagle, snatched him out of the water, and carried him off to have his wicked way with him. Ganymede was placed in the sky, and later his constellation was called Aquarius. The age of Aquarius. It represents, Alan Watts says, that the age of Aquarius represents a time of homosexuality to be promoted in all cultures of the world in preparation of a new man to come. Well, we don't have to wait to see if that's going to happen, do we, folks? It's being shoved down the little children's. I don't know if you heard about the father when they were having gay pride day or homosexual whatever in a kindergarten class. His father had said that when they talked about this, he wanted to come and pick his boy up and opt him out of it. Well, he came to school and they wouldn't even let him go to the classroom. And he insisted and the guy got arrested. The father. Because by God, those children are going to get homosexuality shoved down their throats, come hell or high water. This continues on. Alan says the utopia planned for most of man would be a hell. The closest character in fiction we have for it would be the emotionless, ultra-rational Mr. Spock of Star Trek fame. Emotion is to be all but eradicated from the bulk of humanity. All mystical organizations have this in their agendas. The sciences have a very large role to play in all of this. We have seen how annual celestial events have been used to indoctrinate thousands of generations of people from birth to grave who, never knowing the truth of things, based their entire lives and values in utter sincerity in order to serve a complete system based on micromanaged utter deception. Predating Judaism and Christianity by thousands of years, perhaps even millions, hence its perfection, it is impossible to excuse as simple misunderstanding on the intergenerational manager's part. On the contrary, the same Savior / Son, S-U-N, / Son, S-O-N, fable has been inculcated into the minds and dreams / nightmares of every generation going back into the dark mists of time, crippling each individual's ability to figure out his or her own meaning of things, his place in the universe, way of implementing his own deductions into a meaningful life. He has served what the high priests have taught him was the natural order of things, always to his own detriment, fought in countless wars for God, king, and country, in order that a secret high priesthood, manipulating their publicly visible front priesthood, could have all their tailor-made structures of society working towards an end which was complete in its absolute goal eons ago. The first and most evil form of slavery is that of the mind. In this 21st century, we who have eyes to see watch the master builders salivate in anticipation of ridding the world of, quote, old age man as they prepare to unveil Adam. And then he refers here to MK. I guess that's Mark, but it's, oh, maybe it's chapter 4, verses 5 and 6. I don't know. I wasn't able to figure it out. He is the new improved slave, the new man. is the new improved slave, all the better to serve them with. This new age man will be self-reproducing and incapable of perceiving himself as a separate, distinct individual. The body electric. And then he broke the word down, trick of the elect, electric. How do you plan to take over the world? You must first possess knowledge of human nature. This may take eons of study, watching, listening, perhaps cautiously experimenting with a few captured primitives. Watch how they barter for their needs. Why, when one gets sick or old, the tribe sustains him. So how do you make people selfish? Look how they share everything, even leaving some of their food on that stone for their gods. Now, if I could impress them with a few scientific tricks, they would be in awe of me. The more brave among them might try to kill me, especially when they see my differences. So I'll search among the young males and find one who is, well, let's say, a little different, and I'll show him a few tricks. He must want respect so bad that after showing off his, quote, magic to his people, the praise will become addictive. He will front for me and act as a sort of buffer between myself and the mob. When he comes back for more tricks, I'll tell him fruit and salad simply won't do. I'll need something they can't find for themselves unless shown where to look, something which is useless to them now but will rule their lives in the near future. I might even be able to get them to kill each other over it. But slow down. My little boy will need some fried this extended into the midsection, and I couldn't see that ND. Okay, my, quote, little boy will need some friends with similar qualities. He can be king priest and helped by a descended order of priests. I'll teach each one a special skill, which he can pass on to new recruits. The younger, the better. These primitives have simple ceremonies before and after harvest, at times set by the sun and the moon. Sun and moon, sun and moon. Yes. Color. They need attached power. They already attach power to gold and silver. I'll make lots of little solar and lunar replicas from gold and silver. My little king can scatter a few amongst the fools and say he obtained them from God. He can tell them to return them to that grotto at midnight and have gifts for them at the same place in the morning. I'll make this a routine for a little while at least, and then one day, no money will be given out by the king. He will tell them that God, in quotes, is not happy with them. God loves them so much, he is in anguish over their way of living. He does not know whether to unleash his powers of destruction and start all over again. Nearby volcano begins to smoke because of their sin. Sun darkens due to eclipse. This is in parentheses. Or maybe they would obey him and his laws. King comes down from smoky volcano carrying stone tablets. Will they obey? I can make the sun shine again, or leave them in darkness. They'll fall to the ground and promise everything. They will work for me now. Sun is out, piece of cake. And here's a poem called Michael, written by Robert Browning. That Robert Browning lived between 1812 and 1889. And instead of reading the poem, I'll just explain to you Alan's comments on it. But this... maybe I should read it. Michael was an old shepherd in his 80s when what had been a small loan was suddenly recalled, a common occurrence at that time, the elite having devised means of disinheriting the small family farmer who simply did not figure into their ruler's plans for the future. Well, what's so new, huh, folks? What we realize is that this stuff has been going on back and back and back and back in history. And exactly what's happening today is what they've done over and over. Let me back up here. So Michael was an old shepherd in his 80s in this poem when what had been a small loan was suddenly recalled, a common occurrence at that time, the elite having devised means of disinheriting the small family farmer who simply did not figure into their ruler's plans for the future. The whole world has been forced on using this artificial means of exchange, yet a few people whom we shall never see nor meet decide what the purchasing power of the unit of money is worth today and what it will be worth tomorrow. School children are judged by economists on their earning potential, thus enabling governments to figure out how much to borrow from the 12 international banking families. The whole, quote, science is, of course, based on shyster fraud. The only way it can appear to work is based on the fact that the public accepts it as such, also accepting its magical elasticity. A generation born into a pre-existing bargain where their lives have been promised by government to pay off debt not incurred by that newborn generation is nothing but this ancient Oriental slavery. And here's a poem by Ezra Pound. It's titled Usury. With usury has no man a good house made of stone, no paradise on his church wall. With usury the stonecutter is kept from his stone, the weaver is kept from his loom. By usury wool does not come into market, the peasant does not eat his own grain, the girl's needle goes blunt in her hand, the looms are hushed one after another, 10,000 after 10,000. Duccio was not by usury, nor was Columnia printed, neither Ambrosia, Fridus, nor Angelica had their skill by usury, nor Saint Trophim its cloisters, nor St. Hilaire its proportion. Usury rusts the man and his chisel. It destroys the craftsman, destroying craft. It destroys the... Azure is caught with cancer. Emerald comes to no memling. Usury kills the child in the womb and breaks short the young man's courting. Usury brings age into youth. It lies between the bride and the bridegroom. Usury is against nature's increase. Whores for Eleusis. Under usury, no stone is cut smooth. Peasant has no gain from his sheep herd. Ezra Pound. And it says, prior to World War II, Ezra Pound was accepted as one of the three greatest English-speaking poets in the world. Although an American citizen, Pound was locked up by his government in 1945 to 1958 for revealing the secrets of the Federal Reserve. The press reported on behalf of their masters that Pound was insane. In the above 26 lines from his cantos, Pound intones to us usury, like all middlemen in commerce, intervenes between the spontaneous instinct of the laborer and what he produces, whether it be the building and keeping a house, the shaping of cloth or wool, or the decorating of the wall of a church. With usury, everything becomes abstract, divided, a matter of outside manipulation. The desire to create is killed in the womb, which becomes the tomb of imagination. Over time, the tradesman becomes the slave of the middleman. The power of usury to damage and deform love comes between the bridegrooms and the bride, as material considerations always do. Usury turns love into an exercise of the mind, where the main object becomes the outfoxing of one's partner. Whores for Lucius refers to the inevitable perversion of any natural society, its customs and taboos, when religion joins the money men, the form of money and the method of weighing or counting being irrelevant. Pound defines usury as a charge for the use of purchasing power, levied without regard to production, often without regard to the possibilities of production. And then here was that poem by Omar Khayyam from the Rubaiyat of Omar Khayyam. And I read this to you. We'll do it again. This is a long time ago, 11th century, folks. Just to make the point, what he's making, Alan is making the point here, that this monetary system, regardless of what form it takes, is always illusory, and it always uses usury. Omar Khayyam, in the 11th century, these are two stanzas of a poem. What, out of senseless nothing, to provoke a conscious something, to resent the yoke of unpermitted pleasure, under pain of everlasting penalties, if broke? What, from his helpless creature, be repaid? Pure gold for what he lent us, dross, allayed? Sue for a debt we never did contract, and cannot answer, oh, the sorry trade. 11th century. Omar Khayyam lived in the Persia of the 11th century A.D. He was a tent maker by trade and part-time natural philosopher and poet. He typifies the spirit of every young man. Enjoyed wine, women, and song, interspersed with the need to work. Because of his non-religious views, his literary pieces were generally ignored by the establishment of his day. In verses, that's Roman numerals, and I'm not going to take time to figure it out. Omar gives, in the first verse, Omar gives a secret away that the bankers lent basically nothing except promissory notes, which would be accepted as money. Immediately upon receipt of this loan, with which he planned a better future, he is simultaneously aware that until he has repaid it back, he will begin to resent his work, knowing he is now working for the banker. Think about that, folks. I'm looking for my place. Here we are. Coupled with the sword of Damocles hanging over his head, should he for any reason be unable to work, he is now under tension, which detracts from the imaginative hope he'd had of making his life, say, easier and better. In the second verse, he speaks of the dross allayed or alloyed coin for which he'd exchanged the banker's note. He is then informed he's to repay the loan with real gold, an oral adjunct appended after the fact. Today, governments work on this same principle, repaying loans with gold or real material goods to international bankers. This is more efficient for the bankers, for their guaranteed repayment by governments who tax the people. Those within government who understand the scam are well rewarded for, as the Freemasons say, keeping mum. Mum from memory, M-E-M-R-E, being the word. By using a mirror of brass, this is a quote by Emperor Taizong, 627 A.D. to 650 A.D. By using a mirror of brass, you may see to adjust your cap. By using ancient times as a mirror, you may learn to foresee the rise and fall of empires. And this next is commentary by Alan Watt. He said, outside of those books specializing in economics, there is in this world, so very old with a multitude of books on ancient history, including incidental gossip uttered in ancient Egypt and Greece, almost a complete absence of the one thing responsible for the rise and fall of empires. In Jastrow's Assyria, there is no reference to money at all. A 600-page volume by the great Breasted on Egypt, it is briefly touched on pages 97 and 98. In other famous books on Mesopotamia, Mohenjo-Daro, and others, there is little mention to the one, quote, science that made what is called civilization possible. Christopher Dawson, who wrote widely on ancient times, touched money only briefly. In the Age of the Gods, in almost all works written by famous archaeologists and scholars specializing in ancient history, there is a wall of silence surrounding the mysterious exchange which made it all work. Familiar philosophers of ancient times, such as Plato, Aristotle, Socrates, Zeno, etc., also seemed to suffer from subject-specific amnesia when it came to those responsible for the introduction and issuance of money. There is more to be gleaned from the study of ancient clay records meticulously kept by obsessional city priests of Mesopotamia. We know ancient peoples prior to using money lived in bands and or tribes, similar to American Indians of not so long ago. Digs across Europe have uncovered foundations of communal longhouses where people of the clan ate and slept. All property, tables, benches, etc., belonged to the whole clan. Every member of a clan was responsible for every other member. Elected chiefs owned no more personal items than anyone else. Yet, while this natural system flowed along blissfully, unaware that change of lifestyle could even occur, the takeover of the Middle East and Northern Africa was well underway, the cultures having been remade to accommodate the use of money. Prior to money, slavery was unknown. Prior to money, slavery was unknown. Slaves needed to be watched and guarded. Who would do the guarding if there was no recompense? Who would supply the guard with food? Now he could not leave to acquire his own work. Standing armies are required to subjugate other people and acquire slaves. Without payment, no army could be formed, clothed, or trained, much less kept in the field for even a short time. Without money, they would walk off home. Our official authorized cultural cheerleaders today point to all the advances we have made in the areas of science and standard of living. Yet for every action, there is an equal and opposite reaction. For every scientific discovery, a cultural penalty to be paid. We are taught through education, documentaries, etc., to think of the very few remnants of original peoples as primitive. The very word subtly engineered to subconsciously relate to primate, if. Just look at that word, primitive, primate. We're going to take a break here, and I'll just repeat the last couple of sentences, and I'm going to just do this for the next half hour, folks. It doesn't go on that long, but I wanted to share this with you. And after this break, I'll give you Alan's address, if you don't have it, how you can get the book.
You're listening to FirstAmendmentRadio.com worldwide. Freedom is never free. We need your support today at FirstAmendmentRadio.com.
Roll away the dough.
You have been listening to Jackie Petrou's Sweet Liberty program on the First Amendment Radio Network. This broadcast is also archived and audio streamed on the internet at FirstAmendmentRadio.com. Sweet Liberty is a fully listener-sponsored program. Your donations to support these broadcasts are a necessity. Send your check or blank money order to Jackie Petrou, P.O. Box 190, Millerton, PA 16936. Again, send your check or blank money order to Jackie Petrou, P.O. Box 190, Millerton, PA 16936. Be sure to visit the SweetLiberty.org website. Thank you for your continued support. And stay tuned to FirstAmendmentRadio.com.
All right, we're back. If you have your pen in hand, let me give you Alan's address where you can get this book. This is just the last few pages of the book that we're reading from, folks, and he had a situation when he went to get some copies made. He might want to share it with you next time he's on the air with us. Some real problems trying to get those copies made. But I know everybody that's ordered, at least had pre-ordered book number 3, they were sent out. Alan's address is Alan Watt, A-L-A-N-W-A-T-T, and that is site, S-I-T-E, 41, Box 4, Estaire, Ontario, E-S-T-A-I-R-E, Ontario. And the postal code here, it's a letter and a number, a letter and a number, and a letter and a number. It is P as in Peter, 3, E as in Elizabeth, 4, N as in Nora, 1. So it is P3E4N1. And then you put Canada on it. Make sure your whole full name and address is there on the return, or they won't deliver the mail. And the books are $25 each. This is number 3. And Alan encourages, if you haven't got one or two yet, it would be better to start at the beginning, because they more or less it's like a series. And not to start, you know, at the back of the book someplace, but to read it through, because it follows, it lays a picture of ancient history that is just, we sure never got it in our history classes, that's for doggone sure. The book is $25, and that includes the postage, and you need to send international money, postal money orders. You can get those at your post office, or cash, but not a personal check, or not a U.S. postal money order. He can't use it. $25. And if you want to speak with Alan, he's gracious to take your phone calls. His phone number in Canada is 705-695-0416. But check and see what your long-distance rate to Canada is first, because it can get very, very costly. We're going to pick it up where we left off. This is, we're on page 71 here. He said, we are taught through education, documentaries, etc., to think of the very few remnants of original peoples as primitive. The very word subtly engineered to subconsciously relate to primates. Yet, for these primitives, life has rich meaning so long as their culture is intact and way of life unimpeded by outside agencies. The penalty that, quote, we civilized people pay for progress, who defines progress, by the way, can be determined by psychiatric visits, the profits of drug manufacturers, divorce lawyers, and suicides. the list for the side effects of progress are almost endless, because any artificial system imposed on people can only engender more of the artificial. This is the system, all capital letters, the system we live under. There are masters of this system who plan the future of nations, peoples, and continents with the precision of generals poring over war plans. The only difference is that the map is a long-range business plan. Every part of this economic system, including you and I, are factored into it. We exist for the economy and are kept, quote, up to date on its rises and falls, like a wartime propaganda poured out incessantly from a war room headquarters. A negative declaration from the Red Shield Rothschilds in Britain, or the Green Measure, that's Greenspan, in the U.S., makes governments scramble to their craft, their seats well padded, as they furiously scribble antidotes to fight the overheated markets, the rising inflation, and a host of abstract bombardments, which only they, the trained combatants in abstractions, can possibly fight and delay. For in this war, we are told, there can be no decisive victory. Well, it's just the way it is set up, little man. Shell-shocked with monetary and market terminology, we stumble away to work, fervently praying to the great God of finance that we won't take a direct hit in the wallet, and thanking him for our high priests of finance, without whom, well, we'd have to think for ourselves, wouldn't we? If the truth be told, everything in, quote, our system is micromanaged to suit the economy. Law, civil and criminal, is wound around it like serpents around a pole. That is the meaning of the S overlaying the twin towers of Jachin and Boaz, called the dollar sign. I think, therefore I am, say all high priests and Freemasons. And in parentheses, Freemasons, free sons of Ma, or Am. Those who accept the reality as presented being the dead, or profane as they call it. Does the good shepherd warn his sheep of their functions, which is to be fleeced and to feed the shepherd? Sheep are hybrid animals, bred specifically for their domesticity, uniformity of temperament, in other words, no individuality of personality. They follow the leader instinct, lack of outside maintenance, high quick yield of wool and mutton. When it's time for slaughter, all they can do is cry, bah. What else can an altered being, A-B, do? It is abnormal. That is why the Masonic apron is made out of sheepskin. The first ones to wrap themselves in sheepskin, lower half only, were the priests of Sumer. You may ask yourself, what had they to hide? Is it a coincidence we call other persons you, E-W-E, U-Y-O-U, or you? Before the rise of this is why you need to read the book, because he has some of these words underlined, and he's showing the use of the words that are everyday words to us and what their actual meanings are. Before the rise of priesthoods, with their publicly financed temples, lavish structures of great expenses, came the emergence of, quote, those who know, those who had sciences acquired much, much earlier from, as they say, a previous age. The more complicated workings of they understand basic tribal behavior and instincts, the more complicated workings of individual male and the emotional / intuitive nature of the female. In order to conquer, one must divide. Differences must be exploited after being encouraged. Once trust is gained by first being the knowledgeable benefactor, rules, punishment, and reward can be inserted. The Ben, B-E-N, son of? And then a capital E, plan. Factor. Oh, the gene, agent, becomes the ruler, the wise man, or one who knows. You will have to read this to get all of what he's doing here. Bankers of ancient times, like those of today, knew how to build up peoples into nations, create boundaries or borders marking their claim, and set the people to surreptitiously working for them. They installed kings or tyrants who were draped in the emblems of the tribes, until in the minds of the people, these figureheads were the state. The literati, the priests, were essential in propagating the new natural order of the heavenlies, and the last four letters of that word, the heavenlies, are lies. The Arthashastra of Kautilya, an old Hindu classic, deals with instructions to kings and rulers as to their proper conduct in keeping the system of government. Geez, the system of government. Think about that, folks. And you know, Alan had said this a long time ago, that they were the ones that created the nations. And it didn't really click with me. But when you think about it, when there aren't the borders or the boundaries, there's nothing to, quote, defend. There were tribes, maybe at times fighting tribes, but there weren't actual... These are political, not just geographical, but political boundaries. And, of course, it was as it appears that everything they do, it was built to be destroyed, because now they're creating the, quote, one world. And remember the word international? To inter is to bury. International, to bury the nations. So they created nations so that they could have the money systems, they could have governments ruling people, they could have wars. And then once their plan is so far down the road, then they destroy that to bring forth the new. And when he first said that, that didn't click with me, but did you ever wonder, where did nations come from? Well, this nation, the boundaries were marked out by the king of England. And all of the new colonies that were formed were under contract. These were contracts. The Mayflower Compact, the Johnstown, all of them, they were contracts. And the area that they were allowed to begin to build up or, quote, civilize was all laid out for them. And who do you think was behind the King of England? It's really... Let me go on here. I'm going to read that first sentence of this page again. The Arthashastra of Kautilya, an old Hindu classic, deals with instructions to kings and rulers as to their proper conduct in keeping the system of government. Included is a debate as to which came first in the system, financial strength or military organization. Of course, the debate leads to financial organization as coming first and being more important, since all needs of subjugation spring from it. And he's citing the source here, a source, a book in Indian philosophy. Wars have steadily increased in scope and frequency over the last few thousand years, usually kings or governments seeming to be the only ones who want them, and often against the wishes of the people governed. It appears that none of the scholars writing and recording these wars mentions private issuance of money, business that expands into conquered territories, often plainly stealing resources, the cost of war to taxpayers, or the profit of war to private international, quote, lenders. From the public's viewpoint, wars may be likened the folly of the man described by the Emperor Augustus, who goes fishing with a golden hook, having nothing to gain but everything to lose. History has largely been the interweaving of distortions of truth. History has largely been the interweaving of distortions of truth, both wittingly and unwittingly. Kings became the mouthpieces and sword arms of those semi-secret societies that controlled the material of money, as its outward visible symbols came to be restricted to gold, silver, and copper. Whereas barley and wheat had been used as a medium of exchange in early Babylon, it gave way to the fiat and restrictions of specific metal. This was controlled by the will of those classes controlling the dark side of society. Leaders of the world, of slave traders and drivers, caravaneers, haggling criminals and outcasts who were to be found in the tents on the fringes of city-states or following the trade routes between them. The leaders of these nomadic classes owned the mines which supplied precious metals, the actual mining only being profitable through the abundance of slave labor derived very inexpensively from ongoing wars. So all of their captives from the wars became their slaves, folks. Slaves often part of the interest to these traveling merchant bankers from the rulers to whom they had loaned for the making of war. These men, alien and indifferent to the fate of most stationary agrarian peoples, had made their powers absolute by sowing in the minds of men over thousands of years the belief that their metals had a specifically high value relative to other goods and services offered for exchange, so much so that the hoarding of such metal constantly added to would ensure power, privilege, and happiness. The law expounded by chiefs and leaders to ensure the well-being of the people became corrupted, empty words resurrected in formal ceremony, old symbols raised before the eyes, lest they downward glance to see the evil eating away at the very roots of the trees of life, the tree of life, the fruits of goodness and harmony, a trembling with each bite. This nomadic international group, from the secrecy of their desert encampments, schemed their dreams into existence, utterly indifferent of the consequences to decent, simple people. Extravagant temples sprang up. For now the specializations of priests into ledger keepers, tax collectors, and bureaucrats needed suitable, visible symbols of their newly inflated status. The temple became both treasury and counting house. Scales set around the inner portico for the weighing of metals. The priests formed a brotherhood with the bankers. Their combined control. One of the material world, one of the mind, proving more efficient. In the Amarna Letters from Palestine, Cambridge Ancient History, Volume 2, page 14 to 17, Professor W.F. Albright writes, quote, listen to this, there was also a large and apparently increasing class of stateless and reputedly lawless people in Palestine and Syria to whom the appellation Aperu or Habiru, or maybe it's Habiru, we'll call it Aperu, folks, or Habaru was given. Those were the old alleged Hebrews. It has now become certain that they were a class of heterogeneous, in other words, mixed races, ethnic origins, and that they spoke different languages. Amarna was an Egyptian capital city and received records from the carrying trade between cities, and receiving records from all over their vast empire. The Apuru appeared concerned in the carrying trade between cities, were to be found within every city, yet belonged to none. Does this sound familiar, folks? They had a supranational god at the head of their secret power. A god contemptuous of all other gods and peoples. This god would become in all, over all, invisible, yet all-pervading. We're talking about Jehovah here, folks. The god of such a secretive confederacy, with his control over international movements of silver bullion, would naturally be a very jealous deity, with hatred towards other states' gods. For when money values were based on the exchange value of his silver in such international exchanges, then he and his acolytes, whoever they were, knew that all prosperity in the kingdoms of those ancient times depended on him, and whether he ordained through his servants that silver would be plentiful or not, whether there should be no money and hardship. He was fanatically jealous of this power. Competition was sin. In Professor Albright's work mentioned at the top of this page, he points out the distinct differences between the Bedouin and the Sagaz troops. That's an old Hittite term for Apuru. Around the time of 1500 BC, he further points out that Apuru meant dusty ones in northwestern Semitic and in Syriac, referring to the common characteristic fact that the bearers of this name trudges in the dust behind donkeys, mules, chariots, and wagons of goods. The professor did further investigation of the caravan trade of the 20th to the 19th centuries BC and claims he found strong correlation between early patriarchal tradition of the Apuru when compared with descriptions in Genesis. The mystery of the Apuru or Habaru recurs by their name appearing in cuneiform texts from all over Mesopotamia, Syria, Egypt, and Asia Minor, all of which date from between the dynasty of Agade, Agade, A-G-A-D-E, and the 11th century B.C. The Apuru of later times were also known to include sections of bandits, smugglers, and mercenaries, especially during the upheaval caused by the collapse of the main cities of Babylonia, suffering from spaced invasions by Gutim, Hittites, and Elamites. In the Tel Amarna tablets, Mercer refers to the use of the name Habaru at Babylon in the time of Hammurabi. He further states that a list of gods called List of the Gods of the Habaru was found at Bog Haz Koy by the archaeologist Winkler. The secret societies of a group known as the Habura seem to have existed long before the destruction of Jerusalem by Titus. According to Jost, History of the Jews, Volume 1, Vespasian appointed Rabbi John ben Zakkai chief of the Habaru as ruler of Jamnia. Well, we're almost out of our time here, folks. I might pick this up again tomorrow night, maybe not. I don't know if I'm reading it in a way that you're able to follow it. This is very intriguing to me. the Habaru, the dusty ones, and their jealous God. And then a whole religion is founded on the chosen ones of this God. And then there are Christians who believe that, oh no, it isn't the Jews, it's us. We're the chosen ones. Chosen of a phantom God. So they were a mongrel race at that time. And when you look at the Khazars, which was a mongrel race, Turco-Mongolian bloodline, it makes you wonder if it were those dusty ones, the descendants that were there in Khazaria waiting to be used by the money masters. I mean, these people adopted Talmudism as a religion and then called themselves Jews and allegedly are the chosen ones of Jehovah to rule the world. And if you don't believe that, just get back into the Old Testament and actually read it. And you'll see that that is true. I'll give you Alan's address once again, because we're almost out of time. Oh, we are out of time, folks. Well, we'll be back with you again tomorrow night. I'm glad you're here this evening. Thank you for being here. And I hope you have a lovely day tomorrow. Sleep sweetly tonight and rested. And we'll see you tomorrow. Good night, folks.
Government takeover of the church. This DVD is the most powerful tool we have for waking up those asleep in the pews. The scripture calls for his people to come out of her. The corporate church is the apostate church, the whore that rides the beast. Get this DVD for a donation of $25 from FirstAmendmentRadio.com. Make copies and give them away to your corporate church friends and loved ones. The truth will make them free. They will watch the DVD, Government Takeover of the Church. Order online today at FirstAmendmentRadio.com or call 5-